Well, I think there's tremendous grassroots support for recalling Scott Walker. After all, we had the biggest mass sustained rallies for public sector workers in the history of the United States last February and March. And 30,000 people were circulating petitions in the dead of winter to recall Scott Walker. And a million people signed those signatures. That represents a tremendous base. It's an organizer's dream. And whether the organizers can get those million people out there and maybe another 250,000 or 300,000 people, really twice the number of votes that Barrett got yesterday, then Barrett will be able to win. But that's the challenge, getting out twice as many people as voted yesterday.
Why is Barrett having so much trouble raising money? I mean, of course, he just won yesterday. But given what an uprising, a surge of opposition there was at the beginning of last year.
Well, Barrett isn't a representative really of the forces that were doing the uprising. That's the odd thing about this choice, because he's kind of a standard issue moderate Democrat. And even Rahm Emanuel came out and supported him. That's not going to rally the troops here in Wisconsin. What he really needs to do is represent the forces that brought about this tremendous challenge to Scott Walker and actually brought the recall to bear. If he goes after the few independents that are left, and there's only about 2 or 3% of those people, and I don't know who they are, then I think he's going to lose. What he really needs to do is get this base to the polls and have everyone who signed that petition show up at the polls, and have one out of every 2 or 3 of those people drag a relative to the polls, because otherwise he's going to get beat by all this big money, I'm afraid.
Matt Rothschild, I want to thank you for being with us, editor and publisher of The Progressive Magazine, which is based in Madison, Wisconsin. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Aramati, Naomi Shake, Steve Martinez, and Alcoff, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina does do.
Ich rufe nicht nass, es rufe nie aus und scharfies.
Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist.
Your opposable thumb
means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger. The outsider. The one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Welcome to The Extra Environmentalist. I'm your host, Seth Moser-Katz, along with my co-host, Justin Ritchie. And today, we're bringing you a very special interview with author and filmmaker and professor at the University of British Columbia, Joel Bakken.
That's right, Seth. We have an interview with Joel Bakken about his most recent book on corporate influence on children. But for now, we're going to get this interview started. You are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM. Joel Bakken, you're an author, filmmaker, and professor of law at the University of British Columbia, and your work includes films like The Corporation and the corresponding book, and today we're here to talk about your most recent book, Childhood Under Siege.
That is correct, and I'm happy to be here joining you today.
So, Joel, as you finished writing the book, The Corporation, and making that into a really incredible feature film that really opened a lot of people's eyes to the power that corporations have in modern society today, what have you learned about the influence of corporations on our lives since then?
Well, I've learned that the influence of making documentary films isn't that substantial, because all of the problems that we talked about in the middle of the 2000s have really only gotten worse. And it's with some regret that I say the film turned out to be kind of prophetic, in the sense that I guess our message was that we were on a course towards dysfunctionality and disaster and crisis in society as a result of the increasing power we were giving to corporations. And I'd much rather be here saying today that I felt that the film was part of a movement to reverse that trend, but I think instead the film kind of put its finger on that trend and said this is a problem, and the last 5 or 6 years since have proved that that's the case.
In the film, you talked to some really powerful people. Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like speaking to these people and how that affected the filmmaking?
Well, I think, you know, the thing about so-called powerful people is that in the end, they're people, and they derive most of the power from the offices that they occupy, whether it's the office of a CEO or a congressperson or a senator or a judge. And so, you know, when you're talking to them, they tend to be like anybody else. And, you know, you put difficult questions to them and they sweat like anybody else. And I think that the film was definitely enhanced by the fact that we did have access to many sort of captains of industry and people who were at the core of the problems that we were talking about. And I think, you know, one of the really refreshing things about the film is that you actually hear them rather than hearing their critics say, oh, well, this is what they do and this is what they say. You actually hearing them talking about what they do. And you get the sense, and it's a central idea in the film, that the problem isn't so much with the people. Yes, of course, they're morally responsible and accountable for their actions. But in the end, they are kind of the foot soldiers of a system that's much larger than they are. And they need to be accountable for choosing to do what they do. And I'm speaking in particular of the CEOs that we spoke with. But they're also, and I think in the film it comes out, that they're also human, that they're also concerned about the problems that we are. You know, there's some quite moving footage from the former chair of Royal Dutch Shell talking about how he's concerned about the environment and he's concerned about this and that. And some footage of the former chair and CEO of Goodyear Tire talking about how bad it made him feel to lay off thousands of people. And you get the sense in both cases that, you know, these people are not that much different than anybody else in terms of their concerns as human beings, but they're part of a system that demands that they do inhuman things and that they act in ways that are destructive. And whatever the psychology is that enables them to sort of paper over that fundamental contradiction between who they are as individuals and who they are as corporate operatives, I don't know how that works. I'm not a psychologist, but I suggest in both the book and in the film, we suggest it too, that it has to do with our ability, and some people are better than others at this, at sort of compartmentalizing. The best I've been able to kind of get a sense of it in terms of my own psychology is that when I play hockey, I'm a really nasty person. But in my regular life, I'm a really nice person. And part of that is because when I'm playing ice hockey, I'm playing by a set of rules that are very different from the set of rules when I'm interacting with my family or colleagues at work. And the set of rules basically says your job is to be nasty, your job is to be brutal, your job is to be violent. And so when I step on the ice, I become a different person, not because anything changes inside of me, but because I'm now playing by a different institutional set of rules. And so I think in some respects, it's like that for these corporate executives who do seem to be genuinely good people, but somehow they can hang their life morality on the hook at the door as they walk into their office and then assume the role that the institution requires of them. So that's a very long answer that could go on and on and on about issues of moral agency and moral responsibility and all those sorts of things. And those are all the big issues that underlie the book and the film.
Being a professor of law, you teach and you write and you talk about the laws in our society and how they set that system in motion. And so did you think that perhaps by making the film The Corporation and writing that book, it could get people to push to change those structures of society that are putting people in those pathological positions?
Well, that's the idea. I mean, the idea is that rather than kind of vilifying the people who work for corporations, because there is a lot of that goes on and it's often legitimate, but I wanted to kind of take a step back and say, you know what, this isn't just their problem. It's actually all of our problem, because we live in a democracy, and for whatever reasons, we the people have allowed or created or enabled or facilitated a system that is quite inhuman in many of its dimensions and can really wreak havoc in the world. And we've kind of accepted that that system can simply operate without very much oversight, especially over the last 30 years as we've moved into what many call a kind of neoliberal moment in history, where we're talking about deregulation, we're talking about privatization. So we as a society, through our governments, have created this institution, the corporation, in the image of a human psychopath. And then we've kind of said, well, let's just let it do its thing. Let's pull back on regulating it. Let's give it more power and more authority and more scope through privatization. And we're all doing this as citizens. We're all allowing this to happen. And so we're all responsible and we all need to do something. And the idea with the book and film was maybe if we put this out there into the public domain, maybe if we actually give people a sense of what the legal structure and therefore the political problem of the corporation is, maybe people will start to activate for change. That at least is the idea. And anecdotally, I've heard many stories of people who say they watched the film and it changed their life and they became an activist as a result of seeing the film, or they went and became involved in some different kind of work than what they were doing before. I mean, I've heard many such accounts. When I look at where we are as a society and where we are in terms of corporate power, I have to conclude that the film and book were an absolute failure in terms of avoiding the problems that it suggested we would be moving into if we stayed the course.
Exactly.
Yeah, hey, what do you mean exactly? Are you saying the book and film were a failure? I can say that.
Yeah, you can't say that, Seth.
I'm sorry. No, the book and the film were very great. I've watched the film and it was a wonderful film. Many of these ideas that you talk about in the film and in the book go against the capitalistic norm. And it goes against much of what we learn in school and what we're taught by our politicians and our parents growing up. What has helped you to move past these illusions that hold so many of us hostage into the new understanding that you've demonstrated in the film and in your book?
Higher education, I guess. I think I benefited from some great teachers in the places where I was. I went to a number of different universities and had some great mentors and teachers who taught me not necessarily to be political in any particular way, because I'm thinking of, I clerked for the Chief Justice of Canada. He was one of my great teachers. My dons at Oxford and analytical jurisprudence were great teachers. And I guess what the sort of common message that I took from all of them was not to look at the world purely from a surface perspective, that ideas are highly contingent. And I guess most importantly, that it's a kind of human or social dynamic to treat things as natural and inevitable when in fact they're human artifacts. And to me, that is the fundamental message that I've learned from my great teachers, many of whom were not at all political or left-wing or critical or anything in a political sense, but really kind of taught me that this dynamic goes on, that what we take for granted in the world as created by nature or God is usually something that's created by human beings and in a particular way and serving particular interests. And so if I take that understanding and look at the corporation in that way, you know, you get the corporation film and book. There's no real sort of scintillatingly original insight there. As a lawyer, I know what the law is that composes the corporation, and any other lawyer you talk to knows the same, that basically the law demands that managers and directors always put the interests of shareholders and owners above everybody else's, and that everybody else's interests are just externalities. So, you know, that's not a big secret that I had to uncover.
Well, it's a big secret for many of us who don't really understand what corporations are really about.
Right.
So you're saying that higher education helped you to learn to think critically, or helped you to see what corporations were really about?
Help me to learn to think critically, which then, you know, as a lawyer involved in, I mean, I teach commercial law. That's one of the areas I teach. And I couldn't help but see the corporation as the somewhat bizarre institution it is. You know, as a lawyer, you're trained to understand that laws are created by legislatures and judges and politicians, and it's the job of the police and the judiciary to administer those laws, and that laws are usually the result of conflicting interests in society, and whoever kind of manages to get their interests forward tend to get laws that are favorable to those interests. And so I just kind of looked at that in terms of this inherently legal institution, the corporation. And I, you're right. I mean, it is the case that I think most people found that insight about what the corporation is to be somewhat surprising. And I guess that would be an indication of the failures of both higher education and kindergarten to 12th grade education. We don't learn in school, at least I didn't, about the corporation. And it seems like something, given how important the institution is in the world, shouldn't we be learning about that? Shouldn't we be learning about marketing, which is so important to us? Shouldn't we be learning about how our democratic institutions work or don't work? So there's a lot that we don't learn in school that perhaps we should. And I had the great luxury, and I say it's a luxury because not everybody can take, you know, years out of their life to go and just devote time to studying. I mean, it's an incredible privilege. And I had that privilege. And I think it helped a great deal in enabling me to produce a work like that.
Is a corporation.
150 years ago, the business corporation was a relatively insignificant institution. Today, it is all pervasive. Like the church, the monarchy, and the Communist Party in other times and places, the corporation is today's dominant institution.
I do think there is an overhang over the market of distrust. Listen, 95% or some percent, huge percentage of the business community are honest and reveal all their assets. And got compensation programs that are balanced, but there are some bad actors.
The media debate about the basic operating principles of the corporate world was quickly reduced to a game of follow the leader.
I still happen to think the United States is the greatest place in the world to invest. We have some shakeups that are going on because of a few bad apples.
These are not just a bunch of bad apples.
This is just a few bad apples.
It's not just a few bad apples.
Can't we pick a better metaphor to describe the dominant institution of our time? We present the corporation as a paradox, an institution that creates great wealth but causes enormous and often hidden harms.
I see the corporation as part of a jigsaw in society as a whole, which if you remove it, picture's incomplete. But equally, if it's the only part, it's not going to work.
A corporation is like a family unit. People in a corporation work together for a common end.
Like the telephone system, it reaches almost everywhere. It's extraordinarily powerful. It's pretty hard to avoid.
Gerald Zernstein grinds his own hamburger these days. Why? Because this former USDA scientist, now whistleblower, knows that 70% of the ground beef we buy at the supermarket contains something he calls pink slime. Beef trimmings that were once used only in dog food and cooking oil, now sprayed with ammonia to make them safe to eat, and then added to most ground beef as a cheaper filler. And it doesn't have to appear on the label, because over objections of its own scientists, USDA officials with links to the beef industry labeled pink slime meat.
The undersecretary said, it's pink, therefore it's meat.
ABC News has learned the woman who made the decision to okay the mix is former Undersecretary of Agriculture Joanne Smith, a call that led to hundreds of millions of dollars for Beef Products, Inc., the makers of pink slime. When Smith stepped down from USDA, BPI's principal supplier appointed her to the board of directors, where she made at least $1.2 million over 17 years. She did not return our calls for comment.
One of the questions that comes up periodically is, to what extent could a corporation be considered to be psychopathic? And if we look at a corporation as a legal person, then it may not be that difficult to actually draw the transition between psychopathy in the individual to psychopathy in a corporation. They would have all the characteristics. And in fact, in many respects, a corporation of that sort is a prototypical psychopath.
New findings back up the concern the dispersant BP used so widely may do more harm than the oil itself.
I was more concerned about the corrective than the oil also.
Now, researchers say it appears they've detected a corrective sort of fingerprint in these orange blobs found lodged in the bodies of tiny blue crab larvae collected from marshes that stretch from Texas to Florida.
We're at unprecedented volumes of dispersant used so far.
New Orleans attorneys representing fishermen and cleanup workers who have left boats because they're sick have hired experts to test air and water quality samples. A toxicologist out of Florida found that some of these chemicals are in great excess of risk-based lethal levels, that the current hydrocarbon levels are capable of sterilizing our fisheries and estuary production zones.
The fact that most of these companies are run by white men, white rich men, means that they are out of touch with what the majority of the world is, because the majority of this planet are not a bunch of rich white guys. They're people of other colors. They're the majority. Women are the majority. And the poor and working poor make up the majority of this planet. So the decisions that they make come from not the reality that exists throughout the world.
One is, we could raise taxes on people. That's not the way.
Corporations!
Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on... Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. So, where do you think it goes?
Whose pockets? People's pockets.
Okay. I'll locate your employees, and I will tell them that I'm calling from Acme Recruiting Agency, and that I've got a job that pays them considerably more than what they're paying. Would they mind meeting me for an interview? And when the executive shows up, what he doesn't realize is I'm actually debriefing him on behalf of a competitor, and that there is no job, and that the office that he's at has been rented, and the picture on my desk of my family is a phony, and it's all just a big elaborate ruse to glean competitive information from him. I don't feel any guilt. It's, you know what? I mean, you have to expect that guys like me are out there. We're predators. It's about competition. I mean, it's about market share. It's about being aggressive. It's about shareholder value. What is your stock at today? If you're a CEO, I mean, do you think your shareholders really care whether you're Billy Buttercup or not? You know, do you think that they would prefer you to be a nice guy over having money in their pocket? I don't think so. I think people want money. That's the bottom line.
The profit motive, which drove Fudsey to accomplish so much, may bring out the evil as well as the good.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage, The Zoo Shop, and across the bridge, North Vancouver Music Gallery.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or check us out online at citr.ca.
You are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM.
And you were speaking about the education system, and so many of our social institutions are just given to us kind of as package. It seems like all of these things have always been here in many ways, and so we just accept them for what they are. Right. And so what you were writing about in your book, The Corporation, and also your more recent book about corporate influence on children is kind of where those institutions came from. And that's perhaps the critical thinking aspect of it. But diving more into the education component, how are corporations influencing the education system in the United States and in Canada?
It's a big topic, and it's one that here in BC we're sort of right in the middle of, with the teachers about to go on strike, and the government in this province having pursued over the last 10 or 12 years an agenda in terms of education that is quite consistent with the neoliberal agenda that's prevailed in the United States. It's far further ahead in the United States than it is in Canada, and it has had the support of both President Bush in his No Child Left Behind program and now President Obama in the Race to the Top program. What both of these initiatives have in common, and what many initiatives in the various states vis-a-vis education have in common, is a movement away from public schooling as we know it, a movement towards much more dependence of the so-called public system on private for-profit corporations to create tests, to train teachers, to mark tests, to create curricula, to run schools, often through equivalents to HMOs, what are called EMOs, education management organizations. Large for-profit companies that are in the business of running schools, that go into failing schools and develop what are called turnaround programs. So technology, just and a growing dependence on partnerships, as they're nicely called, between schools and businesses, and between education more generally and the school system more generally and big business. Getting lost in all of that, I think, and I argue this in my new book, I devote two chapters to this, getting lost in all of that are the ideals of public education, the ideals that every individual is entitled to an education of similar high quality, that public education is not just about training people for the world of work, but is also training people for the world of citizenship, and that public education has an obligation to create a kind of critical-minded, informed individual who can quit himself or herself of the duties and obligations of citizenship. These ideas are all really getting lost. And the basic notion is that schools are there to train people to go into the workforce. Schools in inner-city neighborhoods and impoverished neighborhoods should give up on these ideals of trying to teach kids more than simply being able to do some kind of a menial job in some particular industry. So these ideas, these broader ideas that initially were behind the rise of the public schooling system, this notion that there's this intrinsic link between public schooling and the possibility of democracy, this is really getting lost in the United States in a major way. It's not even really part of the discourse anymore.
When do you think we lost our way in terms of looking at education as something that developed an enriching life experience as opposed to job training?
Well, I mean, you can trace it back actually to President Reagan's Secretary of Education. And I do this, I sort of go through a bit of a history of it in my new book, and a report that was written by him called A Nation at Risk. And it was a very influential report, and it basically said that our education system wasn't working anymore in enabling the United States to be the world power in terms of the economy, in terms of innovation that it had been before.
That recently, though.
You know, in the book, I trace a lot of things back to 1980. That's an important watershed moment in the history of the world. And I open the book by talking about that fact, that it was really the beginning of a new and quite different ideology than had held at least since the end of World War II. And it was the ideology I'd mentioned before known as neoliberalism, which is epitomized by the election of Reagan, the election of Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom, Brian Mulroney in Canada. And there was a very conscious shift at that point among policymakers, among public opinion formers, that basically said that the role of the state should be substantially contained, that the role of the state should be limited to enabling markets, to enabling the functioning of capital markets and markets for products and all of that, but that the state and government should not play a role in restricting those markets for the purpose of protecting and promoting various public interests, including the education of children or whatever. So it was a very marked shift, and the education sort of systems beginning to move in the direction that I described began around 1980.
That's wild to me that so recently that our education system has changed so drastically. What is the neoliberal goal for education? And what do we mean when we talk about neoliberalism? And how is neoliberalism influencing our children from an early age?
Well, I mean, I think the basic idea in neoliberalism is, you know, as mentioned, that the role of government is to facilitate the functioning of markets. So what that means from the perspective of education is that you need to train workers for those markets, and you need to train consumers of the products that those markets create. So you need to school children in the virtues of consumption. And I think what that means in terms of public schools is, at a minimum, don't be critical of consumerism. But beyond that, there are all kinds of alliances between marketers and schools that have developed, certainly over the last 30 years, which exemplify that. So you need to kind of school children in being good consumers, and you need to school children in being good workers, or at least workers that the economy needs. And what that means is, and this is very explicit in much of the literature around this, is two or three or four streams of education. You know, obviously you need to train the engineers, the lawyers, the doctors, but you also need to train the people to sweep up and clean up the hospitals and provide, you know, the fast food and everything else. And so the idea within this way of thinking is that we shouldn't really be giving everybody the same liberal education, but rather we should sectoralize it in much the same way that the economy is sectoralized, because our only goal is to train people basically to be workers and consumers. I guess another kind of goal is to not train people or not school people in the virtues of democracy, in the demands of democratic citizenship, in the potential of democratic institutions to actually combine the will of the public and protect the public interest. So that would be kind of the negative side of it. We need to train workers. We need to train consumers. We basically need to train kids that markets are really the only option, that governments have a legitimate role in enabling those markets, but no real legitimate role in constraining those markets in order to protect public interest. So corporations are good, governments are bad. Markets are good, regulation is bad, so on and so forth. And, you know, I'm oversimplifying, obviously, a lot, but these are the kinds of trends that you see when you look at fairly mainstream discourse in the United States about, you know, not sort of Tea Party, lunatic right-wing discourse, but mainstream discourse about what we should be doing with schools. There's very little left of a broader sense of liberal education. There's a great book by Diane Ravitch, and she's a former education mandarin within the Bush administration, but she kind of has a conversion on the road to Damascus and realizes how horrific it all is in the United States. And so she published this book, I guess, about a year ago, and it's called The Death and Life of the American Public School System, something like that. And it's a very, very good account of all of these trends.
Right. And when I hear mainstream discourse coming from people like Arne Duncan or Obama, especially on the higher level, it is very much simplified in many ways. So, you know, you can say you're oversimplifying it, but in a lot of ways, that is the level of the discussion. And I never hear anything about expanding the breadth of education. It's always whittling it down to meet market needs. And I'm wondering that what is it like for a student who goes through this kind of neoliberal, I guess you could call it indoctrination in many ways, but receiving these neoliberal values from a very early age, do you think that they still have the possibility to be innovative and creative in some ways? Or is that innovation constrained within a very small set?
You know, I'm an incredible optimist. I believe that it's very, very hard to completely extinguish the flame of humanity in people. And I believe that really what this is about is humanity. You know, I was talking to my 15-year-old son the other day, and, you know, he's quite thoughtful and quite aware of all these issues, but he's not sort of a doctrinaire. He doesn't see himself as an activist, all of this stuff. And he would just say, I'm really concerned about the public sector in the province of British Columbia with, you know, the government doing this and that and the other thing. And it was really coming from his gut. Like, like he really had this feeling that this was a bad thing, that doing away with public funding of schools and education and all of this stuff, that this was not the way that we should be living. You know, that everybody should have these rights to an education, to proper health care. And this was at a very visceral level. It wasn't sort of a really intellectual discussion. It was just this feeling, and he was genuinely concerned. You know, I like to believe, and I hope I'm right, and I think history to some extent vindicates this view, that having sustainable communities where people care about each other, where there are social structures that ensure that people don't fall through the cracks, where people feel involved in setting the terms of their existence, that these, I think, are fundamental human compulsions. I think we've kind of lost our way. We've really been beguiled by a set of ideas that serve the interests of the few at the expense of the many. And they are beguiling ideas, and they've been wrapped up in notions of freedom and equality that are somewhat deceptive, and that has given them substantial power. But I'm confident that at some point, the contradiction between those ideas, between the messages that, you know, our best hope is to consume as much as we can of the best brands that we can, that the more money we have, the better our life will be, that government has no role to play in trying to help those who fall through the cracks. And if they fall through the cracks, it's their own fault. I think all of these ideas are ones that sharply contradict our innate senses as human beings about what we need and what we want for ourselves and each other. And so I think in the end, they're not that sustainable. In much the sense, you know, you can go back and look at history and you can see people become beguiled by some horrific ideas. You know, Nazism would be the premier example, where they don't see, you know, either they buy into it, or if they don't buy into it, they don't see a choice for challenging it, because out of fear or a sense of oppression or a lack of imagination, they can't see their way out. And so you have this horrific system that somehow maintains and sustains itself for much longer than you would think it should. And I would say the same about the communist regimes in Eastern Europe. But then you see the Berlin Wall come down. You see Nazism end, and, you know, hopefully anyways not come back. So we're very strange when we get together in societies. We seem to be capable of kind of moving in these directions that are directions that don't reflect how we feel and how we see the world as human beings, but somehow we get manipulated, beguiled, hypnotized, whatever it is, into going in these directions. And I think we're in the middle of that now. But I guess I'm optimistic that eventually, you know, the contradictions become too great, because the power holders overplay their hands. They forget that you actually have to try to find balance and try to legitimate what's going on. And I think we're at that moment now. The attempts to redistribute wealth, to enable people to have a decent life, all those sort of things from the 40s and 50s, where capitalism was seen as a balance. And we talk about social welfareism or welfare capitalism or whatever, but balance that's created by governments between wealth creation and profit on the one hand, and various social goods on the other. And that kind of keeps the whole system going. Workers feel they have some power because they have they have trade unions that actually have a say. They have social entitlements. There are redistributive instruments in place. And so the harsher aspects of capitalism are kind of muted to that extent. And the system can kind of bumble along in this uneasy mix, the mixed economy that, you know, social democracy offered for so many years. But now we're kind of moving, or we've been moving for the last 30 years, into a much more fundamentalist, a much less mixed approach, and an approach that says there's only one basic fundamental idea, that it's the market. And we have to, you know, we have to serve that. And if we all serve that, then it will serve us, which is literally, by definition, a kind of fundamentalism. But what that means is that the system has kind of lost its legitimating structures. And that makes it somewhat, I think, vulnerable. And I think the Occupy movement is a great example of how that vulnerability has and is continuing to play out in people actually hitting the streets and saying, okay, this is going too far.
And so the vulnerability is created by the strict adherence to the neoliberal agenda.
Right. I mean, fundamentalisms are inherently unstable, any fundamentalism, because as human beings, you know, what fundamentalisms try to do, whether it's communism or whether it's Islamic fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism or capitalist fundamentalism in the form of neoliberalism, what fundamentalism try to do is they take one aspect of what we are as human beings and they say, okay, that's what we're going to build our society around. So the aspect of ourselves as human beings, as being self-interested, which we are, you know, that's part of who we are, you know, enjoying consumption. I'm not going to dispute it. I like a good bottle of wine. So these aspects, you know, we're self-interested, we're consumers, are part of who we are. What neoliberalism does is it turns that into all of what the society is. So it takes this part and it builds a social and economic structure around those ideas of self-interest, of consumerism, of the freedom of markets, of no redistribution, of a purely formal equality, you know, treat everybody the same. If they fall through the cracks, that's their problem. So that makes sense to us at some level, which is why it has succeeded. But as you increasingly build your society around that one aspect of ourselves, all the other aspects of ourselves, you know, the side of us that's compassionate, the side of us that's altruistic, the side of us that feel that you know, looks at a homeless person and can't really buy into the notion that it's entirely that person's fault that they're on the street, that knows that that's wrong. So all of a sudden you start to have these contradictions. And any fundamentalism, I mean, we're seeing it in terms of Islamic fundamentalism, in terms of the so-called Arab Spring. We saw it in the challenge to East Bloc communism. You know, all of these fundamentalisms are ultimately unstable, and we see that they fail. And I don't think that neoliberalism is going to be the one exception in history.
Yeah, and it's very interesting watching these fundamentalisms begin to crumble, and they start slowly on the edges of society, and they begin to work their way into society. We see it in the examples that you said in the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement. I wanted to think about more of like when you're a teacher in a school, if you have a listener of this show is listening and they're a teacher, are they able to bring these values into the classroom without reaction from the parent? Is it possible to get children to think critically about neoliberal values and the marketing they're exposed to on a daily basis? I mean, can you point to McDonald's or Starbucks? Can you use the real world examples to show children that their value systems are being manipulated and they're being brainwashed in the same kind of, you know, overarching context of the family life, where their parents are probably very much brainwashed in the same way? How are you able to marry those two dichotomous kind of relationships together?
At its best, I think education is supposed to be doing that, especially in a public system. And I think that my experience in touring around with my new book, part of which looks at the sort of hyper-consumerism of childhood today, my experience has been that a lot of parents, regardless of whether they see themselves as right, left, or center, are really worried and concerned about what they're seeing happening to their kids. And I don't think that there are lots of parents who are saying this is a good thing. Again, regardless of their ideology, and it manifests itself in different ways. I mean, I've been doing a lot of talks in the United States, and you know, there'll be some quite conservative people who will really be on board about the extent to which, you know, sexualization and brutal violence, including misogynist violence, are now being sort of pitched to younger and younger children because, you know, it's edgy content and kids are attracted to it naturally. But this is now being quite cynically manipulated by marketers, these kind of kids' kind of natural curiosities and fascinations with sex and violence in some really kind of nasty ways that I document in the book. And so, you know, some conservative people will be involved with it, will be concerned about that, whereas more liberal people will be concerned maybe about the over consumerism, the fact that their kids see themselves completely in terms of the brands that they use, the fact that their kids are on average, and this is from a very good study done by the Kaiser Family Foundation, their kids are spending 8 to 10 hours on average a day on commercial media, you know, being pitched basically the consumerist message, the fact that in kids' schools are being used as platforms for marketing. So parents are really worried about this stuff. And to the point where in the United States, both the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission have been staunch advocates of what's called media literacy, of schools being involved in educating kids not to be so sort of hypnotized and manipulated by the messages of advertisers and marketers. You know, I think there are lots of weaknesses and problems with the approaches that are taken, but suffice it to say that this is something that, you know, that even the federal government in the United States is all over. And if you go to the Federal Trade Commission's website, they actually have some hyperlinks to websites that they've created that are kind of critical thinking about consumerism modules that are designed for kids that they encourage teachers to bring into their classrooms. So, you know, so I see this issue as of media literacy. I mean, there is no shortage out there of curriculum packages and resources that teachers can use to deal with these issues. It's surprising to me that so few do deal with these issues in a sustained way. I mean, it seems an obvious issue for a social studies class to study the social that kids are actually a part of. And there are endless resources. I mean, the film, the corporation we have with an education distributor, we've kind of parceled it into various education modules with question and answer workshops and all this kind of stuff. So that in itself has become a curricular package for high schools, and it's used in high schools, and I've actually gone and been involved in some Q&A for some high schools that are using it. So there's a lot going on. I mean, there's a lot of awareness out there, and there's a lot of concern. One of the things that I question in my new book is, well, if we're so concerned about it, why don't we regulate it? Why are we saying, well, parents and teachers should do a better job teaching kids about the fact that, you know, they're being targeted for 8 to 10 hours a day? Why don't we go back to what we used to do and say, well, you know, at some age, maybe 8, maybe 9, maybe 12, it's not really appropriate to bombard kids with the amount of commercialism that we are bombarding them with. So maybe we should put some restraints on what marketers and advertisers can do. You know, and that's a big debate, obviously, and it raises all kinds of issues.
One of the things that's also a big part of being a child today is not just tremendous amounts of highly polished media exposure that comes from corporations that want to make money off of your children and instill them with a lifelong desire for consumerism. It's also a large amount of prescriptions. And so when you were putting your new book together, what did you discover about the state of the medical system and how medical journals and everything else operates in terms of prescriptions for children?
What I discovered is that over the last 30 years, the number of children and the number of prescriptions in terms of psychotropic drugs that are designed to modify behavior and emotions of children, has gone from basically zero to millions. I mean, in tens of millions, hundreds of millions. In 1980, it was rare for a child and even a teen to be medicated with psychotropic drugs. Today, it's almost as common as taking antibiotics for a sore throat. Many, many kids, millions, tens of millions, as I mentioned, of kids are on various kinds of increasingly powerful and potentially dangerous medications for a growing array of alleged disorders. What I argue in the book is that, you know, I don't take the quite radical position that some do, that there's no place at all for prescribing these kinds of drugs to kids. I guess my view is that this increase, this explosion in the number of drugs and the number of kids probably is partly related to some positive things, to some positive developments in child psychiatry and to some positive developments in the pharmaceutical sciences. That, you know, I'm willing to acknowledge that some number within that larger number of children are being appropriately medicated and that it's making their lives better, and that reflects and represents advance in treating children's mental problems. But at the same time, what I argue in the book is that some other number, I mean, I don't know if it's half or 70% or 30%, but some number of those children are perhaps not being appropriately medicated, that there's a lot of over-medication going on and over-diagnosis, and that the reason for that has a lot to do with some fairly dubious marketing tactics on the part of pharmaceutical companies, A, and B, from the fact that over the last 30 years, the pharmaceutical companies have become profoundly involved in conducting research on the very products that they create. So there isn't much independent research being done anymore. And that creates all kinds of problems of manipulating clinical trials and so on and so forth, which I talk about at length. And see that the pharmaceutical industry has gained undue influence over the medical publication and education systems. So again, that pushes in favor of using their products, when in fact, if you had truly independent science, truly independent education, truly independent publications, you would feel more confident in thinking, you know, that the diagnosis and prescription, the diagnosis of disorders, the prescription of drugs, the various protocols, et cetera, and so forth, have the necessary scientific validity they should. But my argument is that they may not, that there are very good reasons when you look at how the system produces knowledge about drugs and about mental disorders among children. There are very good reasons to feel that the field is tilted in favor of trying to sell more drugs and trying to write more prescriptions. And that is a real difficulty, a real problem. And I devote two chapters to that in my book.
You mentioned dubious marketing practices. What do you mean there by on behalf of pharmaceutical companies getting these drugs into doctors' offices?
I look at a whole bunch of them. I mean, I look at the role that drug reps play in waiting to see doctors. A drug rep is a person who's hired by a pharmaceutical company, usually to represent a particular drug. They schedule appointments or they just kind of lurk in doctors' offices with free samples of the drug and with, of course, the latest papers and research produced usually by the drug company itself, showing how wonderful the drug is, and use often fairly, again, dubious tactics like providing gifts to doctors, learning about doctors' sort of extracurricular interests and chatting them up about that, taking them out for dinner, taking them to fancy golf resorts, and even having sex with them in some cases. I mean, I talk about in the book the preponderance of former and current cheerleaders who have been hired by drug companies to work as drug reps.
Seriously?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's well documented in the book. There's actually a company that is devoted solely to the task of brokering jobs between current and former cheerleaders and drug companies. It's called Spirited Sales Limited. You can go to the website. They are basically hired by pharmaceutical companies to, you know, recruit cheerleaders for jobs as drug reps. But that's just one area. I mean, then there's the area of ghostwriting, where companies will hire a doctor, pay the doctor handsomely to put the doctor's name on a study that the doctor had nothing to do with writing or researching, when in fact the study was written and researched by the company itself. Doctors are paid handsomely to give talks that are allegedly scientific at continuing medical education conferences to their colleagues, talking about how great this or that drug is, when their colleagues don't necessarily know that they're on the payroll of a drug company. And I guess most importantly, and I talk about this at length, is as a result of certain legal changes, again, in the early 1980s, drug companies have become much more involved in the research on the efficacy and side effects of their products. And there are some very disturbing stories that I tell in the book about companies actually repressing, actually hiding, burying adverse studies. I tell the story of a girl named Caitlin McIntosh, who at the age of 12 hangs herself at school. She's being medicated with a drug called Zoloft and another one called Paxil. And long story short, nobody knew at the time that those drugs could increase by three times the risk of suicide when they're taken by young people. Well, somebody knew it. The drug company knew it because that was the result of studies that the drug company itself had done. But the drug company simply sat on that data. There's no law that says it has to publish studies that turn out negative. And that's a real problem. And I talk about that at length. And not to mention just the various ways that a clinical trial can be manipulated and real concerns that often clinical trials on these drugs are, you know, sort of tilted towards, again, I mean, ideally, you want a clinical trial to be run by a disinterested researcher, because there are just too many ways that you can kind of rig the data or massage the results. But the problem is when a pharmaceutical company is running these a clinical trial, it has an interest in the outcome. And, you know, science isn't done best when it's being done by people who have actual financial interests in what the outcome of a study is going to be. So I say, well, you know, when you take all of this together, this is a system that's broken. This is a system that is yielding results that can't necessarily be trusted.
So a drug could have serious negative impacts, and then that drug could continue to be used because the pharmaceutical company would not be obligated to publish those negative clinical trials?
That is correct. There's no law that says drug companies have to publish negative clinical trials. As of 2007, partly in response to the scandals concerning the burying of data, the United States created, we don't have it in Canada yet, but the United States created a public registry of clinical trials. So any company that's doing a clinical trial has to put that fact up on this public registry that's accessible to consumers and doctors. But the problem is, I mean, it's a great first step, but there isn't enough information on the public registry, and it isn't presented in a way that really can do the job of ensuring that consumers and doctors really know what's going on. But it is a useful first step, and hopefully it'll be seen as a first step rather than a last.
You know, even the studies that are not actually done by the drug companies are usually sponsored by the drug companies, by other institutions. That's an interesting point.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a whole sort of very intricate continuum from, on the one hand, a study that's done purely by an independent researcher in a public institution to, at the far end, studies that are done in-house at pharmaceutical companies. And in between, you have sort of everything else along that continuum, including a new phenomenon of clinical research organizations. They're called CROs. And those are for-profit private companies that are basically engaged by pharmaceutical companies to run clinical trials. And there are all kinds of problems there as well, because often they run those clinical trials in developing countries where there are very minimal kinds of regulatory frameworks in place. And there have been some notorious abuses of subjects in those trials. Subjects who are poor and often are lured by the promise of free drugs, et cetera, and so forth. But they are, in effect, guinea pigs for drugs that often have dangerous side effects. So there's that whole other issue, which I also talk about in the book at length.
And we could spend probably hours talking about the psychology that goes into drugs and all of the studies that surround them. We wanted to close out by talking about video games. And, you know the fact that most of these drugs that these children take could be mitigated or prevented even by regular exercise. And children are, you know, more and more turning to video games and electric gaming systems these days. Instead of going outside and playing with their friends, they're sitting in front of their computers and their televisions. It's led to a more sedentary lifestyle, and it's led to less interactions between children. Should there be some kind of age limit on video games? Restrictions that prevent children from spending so much of their free time in front of computers and video systems?
Yeah, it's a very complicated issue, and it's one that we obviously can't answer very quickly. But suffice it to say, you're absolutely right that all of these issues interrelate among themselves. I mean, there's some recent studies have shown that when kids use Facebook on a kind of compulsive basis, that they're always on Facebook, that it actually can lead to depression. And then you have a depressed kid, and that kid is then diagnosed with depression and therefore in need of psychotropic drugs, and on goes the spiral. That if our kids are leading relatively unhealthy lifestyles, sedentary lifestyles, they're being bombarded not only with media, but in consumerism, but with violence, with over-sexualization. I mean, there's good psychological evidence that girls are developing eating disorders and self-esteem issues as sexualization increases in the commercial culture that they're exposed to. Then when you add to that the nutritional aspects, you add to that the various chemicals, and this is another issue that I talk about in the book, synthetic chemicals that kids are exposed to in their food, that kids are exposed to in the environment. You then add to that the amount of sugar and fat that kids are eating, that they're becoming obese. I mean, it is an incredibly unhealthy world that we are exposing children to and that we are creating for children. So video games is a part of that. And then the question is, what do we do about all of this? And, you know, one answer to that is it's really up to parents to deal with these issues. And one of the main points I try to make in my book is I actually think that the problems are much larger than parents can address. And I say this as a parent, watching one of my own kids become pretty well addicted to Facebook, unable to sort of stay away from it, and thinking as a parent, what can I do about this? And so I guess, you know, my book is one large argument for the fact that we as a society have to address these issues. We have to think about what the limits should be on companies that are trying to get money out of us and our children, whether by selling drugs or by selling consumerism or by selling products or by putting chemicals into the environment or by taking over the running of schools or by using child labor. It's another issue I look at in the book. To what extent should kids be seen as a resource for profit making, especially when it's harmful to their health and their well-being? That's really the fundamental question. And the answer is, we have to decide that as a society, and then we have to do something about it. We can't simply say, well, we'll just let corporations target kids